Hey everybody, I'm Bobby Salveson.
And I'm Michael Monaco, and together we are the Hazmat Guys, connecting the Hazmat community near and far with knowledge, insight, and real-world examples in an effort to make your job just a little bit easier and safer.
Now, let's take a minute to hear from today's sponsors. Hey, Mike, pop quiz. What is the standard go-to method for emergency decon?
That's pretty easy. Wet decon, right?
Well, you know, you're not the only one that may be thinking that, but it's actually dry decon.
No. How many times have I heard dilution is the solution to pollution?
Actually, too many. And that's the issue. Makes sense if you think about it. Without the use of water, we don't need to spend extra time setting up traditional showers or pools, and there's no wastewater afterwards. And you're not going to freeze anybody to death if it's below 60 degrees.
Check out firstlinetech.com/drydecon. Firstline Technology has a whole webpage dedicated to the methodology and links to plenty of dry decon resources. See for yourself why dry decon with FiberTech should be your go-to immediate decon solution.
You know, it's time to rethink your level A protection. Multi-threat suits made of lightweight Gore Chempak Ultra Barrier Fabric are part of the most functional non-encapsulated level A ensembles that bring an essential modernization to hazmat PPE. Certified NFPA 1994 Class 1 suits with Gore Chempak Ultra Barrier Fabric offer unencumbered movement, increased range of motion, improved peripheral visibility, excellent dexterity, and reduced heat stress so you can stay engaged longer. You can learn more at GoreTexProfessional.com. Let's get to the show.
Hey.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 338. We are going to be going through the second batch of our cryo tips.
Yeah.
But first, a word from Bob.
This is actually, we're recording this on May 5th. Cinco de Mayo, as they call it, I believe. And I am enjoying an extra large margarita.
The great American holiday of celebrating Mexicans.
Yes. And that brings me to tomorrow is the 34th annual Midwest Hazmat Conference, which will be doing be done virtually. All the presentation will be available on demand for the entire watch and whenever you want, as many times as you want. The fee is $100 for a 50 presentation with 75 hours of first-class training by hazmat instructors, the top ones in the whole country, and it's eligible for HMEP 80-20 grant funding, so your final cost is only $20. You can get the brochure, get it quickly at emorysafety.com, and if you want to, us to mention your conference, even if we're not speaking there, contact Kosh, COSCH at the Hazmat Guys for more info, and that'll get you on the show and the newsletter and a few other places for good measure.
That's less than four gallons of gasoline.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Wow. That's crazy.
That is crazy.
But not to be outdone, our pals up in the cold zone. I'm going there on Tuesday to do a ton of classes. So I'm looking to hanging out with all those guys up there. Cold Zone is May 11th. Baltimore IAFC.
Yes.
Is June 8th.
Yep.
Virginia, we're still on the fence with that one. We're working with them on September 13th. And then Massachusetts, the end of the year, is September 20th. So that's a pretty big one. And then we just we forget to mention this all the time, but the FDNY Hazmat Company 1 shirt locker is open.
Oh, yes.
So you can get FDNY Hazmat and the number 1.com for that. And I was told to give a special shout out to Brandon Leonard from Milwaukee, from Mark Hamilton, a guest of our show once.
Oh,
yeah.
And what are we giving him a shout out for? Just random.
I just heard he's a nice guy.
Okay. Hello, nice
guy.
But he's
a big fan. Big fan of Milwaukee. And I might see him in Cold Zone. Who knows?
With Chuck, right?
Chuck Fleury.
Fleury. That name is perfect for a Cold Zone. Like it sounds like a blizzard. Or a superhero.
Yes.
You know, like one of the Avengers.
I love it. Yes. So take us into episode, what is it, 338?
This is episode 338. Last week we were going through cryogenic response tips,
right?
And we were kind of going through some of the different things, and we actually got pretty enough involved to split it into two episodes. So if you're sitting there thinking, I don't really have to listen, you know, like whatever, go back, listen to the first one, because, it's got good stuff. At least the three other people that listened to the episode think so.
I agree. So in this one, I believe, let me just go back and just look at my note. We went through the first aid. We left off with first aid.
Yep. We finished up first aid. We talked about, you know, researching the material in and of itself.
Right. And now we're going to get into PPE. The question everybody always asks is, what do you wear? And this is like the, I'm going to say this is one of those topics that, like, you can never speak enough about. Because everybody's got these questions about, like, you know, what do I wear? Am I going to do it wrong? But it's going to be difficult and easy at the same time. One of the number one things that we have to remember is that our bunker gear, well, our firefighting gear, is not designed to protect us from cryogenic liquids, right? So one of the things you see all the time is you'll see guys using their fire gloves. And it's like, don't do that, man. That's going to be a valuable lesson for you soon.
Yeah, that'll, that'll be painful. Or not painful, because as we learned in the last episode, it won't be painful.
No, it will not be.
Go listen
to that. And because even the plastic chemical protection that we usually see from like 1991, 1992, 94, or all rolled into 1990 now, don't really provide thermal protection in any way.
Yeah, now for those of you that are out there that are going, hold on a second, and I'm sure there's at least four of you out there that are going to disagree with what Bob just said, and the others of you have no idea what I'm about to say and are going to scratch their heads when I say it. There's four of you out there that are going, hold on, I thought the 1991 suits were cryogenically tested. And yes, they are. There is testing in the 1991 standard for level A when it comes to really, really cold, cryo-ish temperatures, but it's not a thermal test. All right. Now, if you're inside the suit, it's not going to thermally protect you. Okay. All the cryo test does is make sure that if that suit freezes and moves around, it won't crack and allow the chemicals to penetrate through or diffuse through or whatever technical term you want to use that says chemicals get through the suit. That's all it does. It doesn't actually protect the wearer from any kind of thermal harm.
That's a important thing, because people think, well, I'm chemically protected. And part of that whole traceum thing is thermal. The T is thermal.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's a hazard, and yet that PPE may or may not be the one that you need for the scenario. So with that being said, we're going to have to augment our bunker gear, right? Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Got to put special stuff on top of our special stuff.
Exactly. So now what's nice about responding in the bunker gear is that it kind of fits the criteria of stuff that we want on us if we get accidentally spilled or splashed by a cryogenic liquid. I like that it's thick, right? It's an offset of my skin, and it's bulky, and it creates a distance barrier from the cold. And you can almost still think about bunker gear like in this whole thickness thing. It's a plus for radiation. You know, it's an offset. It pushes it away from us. So it's a good thing, because the distance gives us time to take off the clothing if you have an emergency.
Yeah. And with that, you know, that's what we're wearing on top. On the bottom, we absolutely want to wear closed-toed high boots, recommended across the board. And our firefighting boots, for the most part, fit that category. Now, remember, there's no official thermal protection against it, but just like our bunker gear, it's going to provide limited distance and time. For, I guess you could say, an accidental spill. I, by any way, shape, or form, would not go wading through a pool of cryogenic material. You'll end up like the Terminator 2, right? You'll just kind of shatter into a million pieces. But knowing that my 10 little piggies will most likely be okay if cryogenic liquid is splashed. That's a a really key word, and that's actually a word that we don't use enough when we're separating PPE out in other things, but that's a whole different podcast and a whole different episode. But that accidental splash is what we're looking to protect ourselves against.
Right. Now, the two areas I would definitely augment my firefighting gear is going to be the gloves and the apron. Because if you think about it, that's the main points of connection between where you're actually operating. I would say this is the majority of why that most plastic chemical protective suits now have rear entries, because it's generally a cleaner area for us to get in and out of. So these two things, the face down to the, I would say maybe the knee, and the hands, because you're actually operating. So the gloves have to be specific to protect against cryogenic liquid spills. And one of the things that's important when you're picking out these gloves is they need to be oversized, right? It's not like, oh, this is so skin tight, I could pick up nickels. You don't want that.
Right. Yeah. Right? And that's why we don't want to go with our fire gloves, right? Because it's hard to get the fire gloves off.
Yes. And it's done on purpose, this whole sizing thing, right? Because even they're not really designed to be immersed or even operated in a cryogenic environment. There's a safety factor to give enough distance, and that thickness, that size, lets you get them off as quick as possible if they get saturated or even doused with cryogenic materials.
Yeah, it's like watching two hockey players go at it. They kind of throw the gloves off and they start, right? That's
yeah,
that's exactly what we're looking for. Just don't, you know, knock your partner out thinking you're on the rink. So even though we don't operate with the apron, I think it's really important that you should have one. And it's probably something we might actually want to push for within where me and Bob are. The bunker gear, the reasons for the apron, right? Like, why, if the bunker gear does all the stuff that Bob said it does, why would I augment it with an apron? And it's because the bunker gear is not rear entry. So it has all of its opening and all of its clips in the front. And if you get doused with cryogenic material, it's going to go through the buckles. It's going to seep in. Even if you have zippers, it's going to seep in through there. It's going to freeze. It's going to make it difficult to get in. Right. So we're really looking to protect those weak points in the bunker gear with an apron.
I think it's you got to think about it. Like, the bunker gear is not designed for this.
No.
It's not designed for this, but we're thinking about it intelligently and saying, okay, if I add this one sheet of plastic here, and when I say that apron, I'm thinking like the horror film,
yes,
like butcher a Dexter guys,
like, yeah, a, like Dexter, a Dexter apron. Yes,
that's what I'm talking about. Like a rubberized, like, yeah, I'm hacking bones and kind of stuff. That kind of apron we're talking about. They're talking like a Kiss the Chef or a we're in for the crab fest kind of thing. We're talking about a real apron, you know. So with that, material handling, let's talk about that.
Okay.
It's entirely possible that we're going to be able to deal with these physical items that have come in contact with cryogenic materials at their release. A funny story. Were you there for that one, what was it, liquid nitrogen that let go in
Manhattan?
In a major, yes. Yeah. And a car driver, and it was going down the gutter.
Okay.
Where the rainwater would go, and cars are parked along the sides, and a car driver was impatient and he wanted to leave. He was very important and he had to get to his appointment, and we're like, you really shouldn't do that. No, you shouldn't drive your car. And the tires stayed and the car moved.
Oh God, I wish that was on film.
They dissociated, we'll say nicely. But you got to think about, we might have to actually get in there and touch things that were affected, like those tires or something like that. And you can't just go in there with gloves on and pick up any material that's been submerged or made contact with these things. So the cold actually pulls the heat through the gloves very, very quickly. And so it's important to have some kind of buffer or device to pick up the materials that we have that has had made contact with the cryogenic, like a shovel, like a picker-upper. I don't know what one of those grabby little...
Yeah, the old lady
Yeah, get some off the high shelf.
Yes,
kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And if we're unable to do that, and we have absolutely no choice but to touch an object, we want to use gloved hands, right? If we know that we have a material that has been submerged, we know its temperature is going to be extremely, extremely cold. We want to use the gloved hands, but we also want to try to use time as, you know, almost like radiation, right? Like we want to do it very, very, very quickly. And a thermal imaging camera can help us determine the temperature of the product that we're going to be coming into contact with. Now, with that being said, be careful just grabbing any old thermal imaging camera. They're not really designed for cold. They will show you that it's cold, and I don't even know if their thermometers are going to go down. When I talk about using a thermal imaging camera, I'm really specifically referring to those that are like hazmat type thermal imaging cameras. And if you don't have that, get yourself a laser temperature gauge. If you didn't hear yet, we are transitioning to a new format that is going to give you, the listener, even more content.
Yeah, for example, in our technician and specialist levels, we are adding even more video content, access to our entire show catalog, and even access to a monthly small group Q&A session to answer any questions that come up, as well as so much more.
All of this for less than a cup of coffee that you premium snobs like to drink for the entire month of access.
This is the stuff that you've been asking for. So take a look at what we can do to take you to the next level of hazmat.
Go to our website, thehazmatguys.com. You can sign up for our premium tiers that will give you even more hazmat goodness.
Yeah, because a vast majority of them start at relatively low temperatures, like 10 degrees Fahrenheit. That's not cold enough. When you're talking about liquid oxygen or something like that, you're talking hundreds of degrees below zero.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not really made for that. So we are also going to have to, weather permitting. You said time, and it's kind of an important thing. If the guy with the tires just waited, you know, if he just waited, cryos are not very cryo anymore.
Right. They warm up. Now I wonder, though, if he had stuck around, would we have been like, you need to replace those tires? Like, is the
vulcanization?
Yeah, the physical property of the rubber now.
Man, that's a good question.
I try to only ask the good ones.
You know, because there was something that happened, I want to say in like Festivus, Missouri or something like that. There was a chlorine leak. And they said that all the tires in the vicinity were destroyed because the chlorine attacked the vulcanized rubber.
Sure. It's petroleum.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And then, not that this has anything to do with hazmat response, but I wonder if that guy could have turned around and been like, hey, listen, like my tires were damaged because of your spill. You better pay up for new tires versus now he drove away and he ripped his own tires off and they're going to be like, no, man, sorry, you were told to wait.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Join us next week on a legal legal discussion.
How to recover your frozen tires, episode 339.
Wow. Well, all right, let's get back to this.
Okay.
Situational permitting, water is an excellent way of warming up materials that are super cold, right? We just don't want to be really careful with, we're not physically touching something that can inadvertently freeze us. Water is one of those things that's like, it's such a weird thing. We should really do like a whole series on just water because it is such an interesting chemical.
But you know what? Of all, I don't think we've done an episode on water at all.
I'm writing it down right now. Yeah.
All right.
I'm going to start investigating it. Dihydrogen monoxide.
How it can kill us and burn us and drown us and is essential for life and is so delicious when put through a reverse osmosis filter. So the next thing that we want to focus on, right? We have some kind of a cryogenic thing. Because of everything that we talked about before, there's most likely, especially if you're inside, there's going to be some level of evacuation. And with evacuation always comes the question of when can we bring people back into the scene? And hopefully you guys are aware enough to understand that there's different levels depending on what that occupancy is used for, whether it's a residential, whether it's a commercial, whether it's industry. And this is a question that comes up a lot, and it can be a little disconcerting for the incident commander, right? Because there's a lot of information going on, and we're going to start seeing these occur more and more. Mainly because of the material that's out there, the CO2, the liquid CO2 that just within the past couple of years has started occupying a lot of the places that give out beverages. As these systems start to get older, we're going to start to see more and more of these emergencies take place. So if you haven't had a cryogenic emergency yet, be ready for it, because there's probably a gas station or a movie theater or a restaurant in your area that absolutely is using CO2.
Yeah, and with that, how do we know the CO2 is there, and cryogenics expansion ratios and et cetera? You know, metering is going to be a huge component of that whole thing. And so when it comes to reoccupancy, you're talking about using meters extensively in that decision process. And it's going to be similar like other gases, but let's walk you through what these issues are.
Yeah. So for the most part, right, because we talk about CO2, and if you don't know, you should absolutely have your own CO2 meter. Okay. Yeah. That is a hands down, like that should be something that every hazmat team has at their disposal. But most of you all don't, because again, this is new and nobody's really died of it yet. So we're a reactive organization, not proactive. So you're going to be going in with your 4 gas sensors that are not going to pick up any of the cryogenic materials unless you have that specific sensor in your 4 gas. The only thing that it's going to pick up is your O2 and your O2 sensor. And it's not necessarily a really good indication of whether or not something's there.
No, we've talked about this on seriously countless shows about how poor of a tactical decision-making piece the oxygen sensor is. A lot of people put a lot of water into that thing. But you got to remember that when we have a 1% of 1 million is 10,000, period. That's math. But the oxygen sensor is that 5 times 1, the only sensor that's 5 times it. So 1% drop in oxygen is 50,000 parts per million of a substance, some substance that's in the atmosphere. So our oxygen sensors pick up 0.1, right? You get 20.9. So if I have 0.1, that's 5,000 parts per million. You see what I did with the decimal point there?
Yep.
Right? And so now the PEL of CO2 is 5,000 parts per million.
Ooh, sorry about that.
Oh, it's okay.
Ooh, I got a little tickle in my throat.
He's all verklempt.
I'm feeling very verklempt. I'm verklempt because, right, like you may be sitting there and you may be going, all right, well, wait a second. If I just wait for my O2 readings to return to normal, right, that 29.8 or whatever normal is, then I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be clear to give the thumbs up and I can reoccupy. But here's the problem. A lot of people don't realize is that many of our O2 sensors, they have a little bit of wiggle room in the beginning. All right. They understand that this small little drop in O2 is gonna cause alarms to go off. And
yeah,
sensor drift is going to be a bigger component of oxygen loss than actual oxygen loss. So in order to combat everybody just getting off their rigs or going up a couple, you know, just whatever, that sensor is not going to move from 20.8 to 20.7 unless there is a significant over 5,000 parts per million CO. So
yes,
you don't see that kind of fluctuation. And that means that I could technically have 5,000 parts per million of CO in the atmosphere and end up reading a normal concentration of O2.
Yeah, we've talked about, what do they call it? Dead banding.
Dead banding, yep.
Dead banding. It's a software feature, or if it's a software bug, you decide whether you like. But it is something to be aware of. So our next recommendation as far as this, in our tips for responding to cryogenic emergencies, is to find out what cryogenic materials are running through your area. Make sure you have some means to detect them. And just saying, well, I'm going to look for oxygen displacement is not really a good way of you saying, this is my means to detect them.
Right.
You know, you should maybe think about something like Draeger tubes, right? Draeger tubes are a great choice at this point because we're looking for relatively specific chemicals and we're not doing continuous air monitoring. We're doing samples. So when I think of samples, I take a sample, like I scoop up or I suck in, and then I test it. It's not continuous, like I'm walking around a whole building looking for this thing. So I could use a Draeger tube at the far end of the operation when I'm thinking about a reoccupancy, or I could just make sure that my Draeger tube has the ability to see the chemical below the PEL.
Yeah. Another alternative is to get the actual electrochemical sensor for that specific commodity running through your area. Guys, honestly, this would be my choice. There's plenty of technology now out there where you can take a sensor, you can have it on the back burner. It's not being used, it's not being degraded. And when you're ready to use it, you take it out, you plug it in, and you go forward. As we said before, when it comes to CO2, there is no reason why you shouldn't have a CO2 electrochemical sensor or an NDIR sensor, whatever technology you prefer to go to. And that will allow you to continuously monitor the atmosphere versus trying to do the Draeger tube one spot, one moment in time. Oh. Yeah, it's, you know, you're sitting there pumping, you're counting. I'm ADD, so I'm talking while I'm doing it. I forget the number of, it's a mess. I'm horrible with Draeger tubes. I'm a mess. So whatever that electrochemical sensor should be, is you should have that. And there are plenty of ways to know what commodity is running through your area. That should, you know, if you're running a team, that should be the least of your concerns is how to get that information.
Yeah. And all right. So now let's just, this is one of those wives' tales that we go above and beyond to try to dispel. And it's kind of a simple thing when you think about it, is that people think, mostly because of the movies, I think, is absolutely, that, you know, if a cryogenic is leaking, you're going to see this enormous cloud that's there. That's not necessarily true, right? If you see an enormous cloud, it's because it's expanding outside of the container, going through a rapid phase change, chilling out the air around it, and kind of freezing the humidity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that change of phase is why you see a cloud. If you don't see it, it means the displacement nonetheless. But I'm saying it's happening so freaking rapidly outside the container, that's why you see it.
Yeah. I mean, look, what is oxygen? Minus 200 and something? So yeah. When it becomes a gas, you have to remember, guys, it's not a gas at standard temperature and pressure when it's coming off the liquid. It's a gas at minus 200 and something degrees. Right. That gas is going to freeze the F out of the water that's in the air. It's just, it is what it is. Now, if you're in the desert, this probably isn't going to be that big of a deal. And I don't know for that for sure. I'm taking a guess because, you know, in New York City, the humidity is around 150 to 175% in the middle of the summertime. Yes, I'm aware those numbers don't actually exist, but you come to New York City and throw on bunker gear and you tell me it's not 170.
Terrible hair.
Yeah. Whew, you're stepping on things that you should never be stepping on. And I might be wrong. In the desert, there may be just as much of a cloud. But when you're dealing with low humidities as, you know, 20, 30%, it's not going to be as dramatic, right? The cloud greatly limits our visibility, especially when we're working outside with transportation instances. These clouds can quickly overrun the scene. And if you're inside, the whole room could just be clouded.
Right. So there's an old adage in firefighting is that if you can't see your feet, don't be on them. Right? If I can't see where I am actually operating, then you should be a little more leery of working in that atmosphere. So, you know, I would try to change the environment as much as possible by putting a couple of fans, putting a fog line. What about putting like a duct over it and redirecting it 10 feet away so I can actually see what the hell I'm doing here?
Right.
You know? That's
so, and we have those capabilities, right? Listen, if you really, really need to, cut a 3-inch hose and put it over the cuplink that's leaking, if it's a coupling. You know, like there are, what Bob is saying is there are things out there that that you could do, right?
Yeah.
The hose line is one of them. A fan behind you,
right,
is one of them. And yes, that may mean that you have a dedicated person in the hot zone with you moving around with a fan so that you can see. But you know what? You're prima donna. Figure out how to get everybody to work for you.
I am very... I am so fancy.
I want a fan blowing on me at all times, and I want yellow Skittles. End of story.
And when I get out, I want people with palm fronds waving them and keeping me cool. Totally has to happen. So within cryogenic systems, especially transport systems, we want to make sure that we never do anything that's going to overpressurize the system. And we actually had one of these where it was an inadvertent. The guy was a relatively new driver. And when he closed, you're supposed to close the valving in a specific order. And so what happened was he closed the valving on one side and he closed the valving on the other side. And there was liquid oxygen, I think it was, in the hose warming, creating pressure. And so these tanks, these hoses, these fittings are designed to keep liquid cold. They may not be may not have structural integrity at higher pressures.
Yeah. And as Bob was saying, when you isolate things within tubes, you take the pressure reducing device out of the equation.
Yes.
Right. That's the big deal when you're turning things on and off improperly, is that you're trapping it, and now there's no way for that to off gas and off vent. And that can blevy. Like, you can have a blevy of a pipe. That blevy of a pipe can damage other pipes. It could damage other valves. It could, in a transportation incident, it could damage the actual vessel itself. Just harping on that a little bit more, we absolutely don't want to just be going off, turning off valves.
You said something there, and I want to stop because I'm guaranteeing there's a couple of people that are going, wait a second, he just said blevy. He must be misquoting something.
Don't
conflate boiling liquid as heat application, meaning like fire. Because in a cryogenic, where we're just talking about, let's say in the hose or whatever, you have boiling liquid. And the heat application is ambient temperature.
Yeah.
No, so that's no, true.
It's not supplying a blowtorch to it. Like, it's right. I mean, think about it. It's hundreds of degrees hotter
than it wants.
And it wants to be. No different than if I were to apply heat, you know, a flame to water. Hundreds of degrees more.
So it is, guys that are scratching your head, what he's saying when he says the word blevy, that is the literal definition of what he just said in a cryogenic. Almost everything has a blevy potential in cryogenics. I think everything has.
Yeah. And that's a term called a triple point. And I believe we even did a podcast on that when talking about gases and the ideal gas law.
Yes.
And looking at the compressed gas handbook for that information.
So our last recommendation, unless you really know what you're doing, wait for subject matter experts to give you an idea of what needs to be done. Like, I know cryogenics, I know the chemicals, but I don't know how the rigs work. You know, like the truck. What valve do you open or close in a certain order? I don't know that.
Yeah.
And so for the most part, there's no pressure building up in a cryogenic incident. It doesn't need to be rushed. Isolate, do your restricted recon and decon, take pictures, take your time, do your research. Be very careful of turning things off. We see these cryogenic doers on the streets in Manhattan and stuff, and people like, and first two companies are like, yeah, we just shut the valves off. I'm like,
yeah.
Which
valves did you shut off?
Yeah, we don't know. And like, you talk to the experts and they're like, don't either turn them all off or don't touch them until we get there. And that's a good thing. So just going in and turning everything off can be catastrophic as turning things on.
Well, that wraps up another episode of the Hazmat Guys. You can find us at Facebook, Twitter, and our YouTube channel. And don't be afraid to use that like or follow button. Or
you can sign up for even more content from us at thehazmatguys.com. Here, you can subscribe so that we can connect you to even more great stuff. Your support is going to help us improve and build this awesome community even more.
Yeah, and if you want to get to the next level, you won't want to miss our premium content. Our specialist level provides you with access to our entire catalog of shows, which is now over 300, an exclusive Facebook group, premium video with no ads, and so much more. Also, check the Hazmat Guys University link on our website.
And don't forget, we are always interested in hearing about incidences or calls that you have experienced. We may bring you on the show to share that story. Reach us at feedback@thehazmatguys.com.
And remember, folks, don't just get on the job, get into the job.